This is Puget Sound Now, a look inside the issues happening in our communities around the Sound.
There are reasons to believe we're finally coming out of the COVID-19 forest.
So we will be removing the mask mandate in our schools and in our public indoor spaces as of Monday, March 21st.
On September 16th, 2021, we announced King County's COVID-19 vaccination verification requirement. At that time, we were near the peak of the Delta wave that was causing significant stress on our healthcare system, and we anticipated increasing COVID-19 transmission during the subsequent fall and winter.
Our success in vaccination and decreasing case counts and hospitalizations are why today I can announce that we will be lifting the local health order that requires proof of vaccination to enter certain businesses and venues beginning March 1.
Important decisions announced this week by Governor Jay Inslee and King County Executive Dow Constantine. Good morning, Bill Swartz hosting another edition of Puget Sound Now. A full 30 minutes to get a closer look at important stories in our world and oftentimes find some solutions. This morning we talk about worker shortages on the water and the roads. There's a new regional high school showing teenagers the possibilities in the maritime industry.
My goal is to connect the folks who need power, who are our students, to those who have power in the maritime industry, so that the maritime industry can be powerful.
A deep dive into maritime high school. Wanted, truck drivers. In Mount Vernon, Washington, they have three schools in big demand.
Been constantly about 3 to 4 months out, filled up with students.
But first this morning, 10 years ago, Washington voters approved an initiative legalizing possession of small amounts of marijuana. The state became the first in the nation to allow sale and use of recreational pot. Since then, heavily regulated cannabis growing operations and retail stores have popped up all over the Evergreen State. One problem, because marijuana possession is still illegal under federal law, it is a cash-only business. And recently, that's led to a rash of extremely alarming armed robberies from Snohomish to Pierce County.
They came in the door, and it was between the turn and actually entering the door that both of the guns came out.
Kevin Heiderich owns House of Cannabis in Tacoma.
A little bit of physical violence, which is super upsetting.
According to Washington Department of Health, there are now 103 recreational cannabis stores in the state, but many more offering medicinal products. Joining us on Puget Sound Now, Aaron Pickus, spokesman for Washington Cannabis Association. Aaron, in the first decade, how has the cannabis industry grown in Washington?
A lot of lessons learned just by nature of being the first, frankly. Today, in Washington State, we have a thriving industry that also, you know, grapples with a lot of challenges that other legal businesses don't. One of those is that at the point of sale between the customer and the retail business, it's still predominantly a cash transaction because of ongoing federal prohibition. That's something that is a major public safety concern. It's a practical concern that other legal businesses do not have to deal with. And so, you know, there are things like that that we are still working very hard with our members and with our federal delegation and state leaders to normalize the legal cannabis market. So we conducted a first of its kind economic impact analysis of the state marketplace to capture, you know, what are the scope of jobs? What's the scope of the tax revenue generated by this industry, the wages generated? And what are some of those barriers to continued stability and growth that we're seeing?
Give our listeners an idea about the economic impact of Washington's marijuana industry.
So in Washington State today, 10 years since the adoption of Initiative 502, the regulated cannabis sector, retailers, producer processors, transporters, labs, together directly employ 11,330 workers. And that generates more than $1.4 billion in business revenues. This is 2020. Total wages and supplemental benefits are realized in $465.4 million to workers. This is all based on more than 1,600 unique businesses in our regulated market. And this is across the state of all business types. And what we see is overall, a total statewide economic impact of $2.7 billion in business revenues, which is creating over $1 billion excise tax revenues to the state over the next biennium, not to mention the millions of dollars in local sales tax and state sales tax revenue that the industry generates. And this continues to grow. So clearly, it's a major and growing sector of our state's economy, but you know, grapples with some unique challenges that other legal businesses don't. In Washington state, we have what's called a residency requirement. And so you're only allowed to own part or all of a cannabis license if you're a resident of Washington state. This means that you cannot access capital from outside of the state like any other legal business. No other legal cannabis state in our country has this barrier. And it's really holding local businesses back as they increasingly have to compete with brands and other companies from outside of Washington state.
Let me stop you right there. So in the state legislature, you are pushing for a bill to change that. Where do we stand there?
So there has been a bill each year on this. We did testify in support of that bill. It is not advancing through the legislative calendar. It did not advance out of committee this year. It's a priority for our membership. If we think that it is a fundamental barrier to the success of local businesses, their ability to invest in their workers, their ability to invest in R&D, their ability to provide, you know, competitive benefits. And really, you know, what we hear over and over from members is that, you know, by nature of going first, we have the most experienced workforce, the most experienced knowledge of the still relatively new industry in Washington state. We should be capitalizing on that and not losing that know-how to other states that came after us. You know, along with that and some other regulatory considerations that we're looking at in order to align the competitive landscape of our state with what's already occurring in other states are a really big focus for us. There's also a currently moving through our court system. There is litigation around this issue on access to capital. So there's kind of multiple fronts regarding this really critical barrier that we're seeing for businesses of all types. Most cannabis businesses are pretty small. And this is something that is relevant across the whole industry.
What is visible and tangible to our listeners on Puget Sound now are the increase in rash of armed robberies. And not only the employees' safety in jeopardy, but customers have been held at gunpoint. And there's been violence committed in these stores. What have your members, your owners of these cannabis stores had to do to try and ensure their safety and wherewithal?
It's true there has been an alarming and recent spike in armed robberies that are predominantly targeting retail businesses, but we have also seen producers, processors, and transporters targeted in this spike. It's been confirmed by law enforcement across the state as an issue, and we believe that it requires a coordinated response with multiple tactics because there's probably multiple reasons that are fueling this spike in armed robberies. So putting worker safety first, we're working with members on how we can share best practices across the industry when it comes to security protocols. If you have the means, and it's very expensive, but if you have the means, armed security is obviously very helpful. So for those businesses that can afford that, they're certainly looking at that or increasing the level of armed security if they already have it in place. You know, best practices around ID checks and customers entering the store, things of that nature. We also are working with leaders in Olympia on funding a statewide task force in the current budget that would bring together local and state law enforcement and other relevant agencies with industry stakeholders on putting together specifically different policies that could be part of the response to this spike in robberies. There's also a bill that is being heard in committee in the House Public Safety Committee Friday morning that passed out of the Senate unanimously that would increase the penalty for targeting a cannabis business for robbery and align it with the penalties that are already in place for robbing a pharmacy. So just one of many different tactics that we think should be part of an organized response to the crisis we're seeing. Long term, the unique nature of retail cannabis businesses having significantly more cash on hand than, say, a 7-Eleven or other legal business types is a real issue. And it's why we have long supported the adoption of the Safe Banking Act at the federal level. It has the full support of our entire state delegation. It's a very bipartisan issue. It's passed out of the U.S. House, I think, 6 times with overwhelming bipartisan support, and just hasn't yet been taken up by the Senate. This is an issue with broad consensus on public safety. It has the support of representatives of our, you know, major banking institutions, attorneys general. And it's really time that short of legalization of cannabis, whatever your opinion may be on that, we should normalize banking practices in this industry to address these public safety concerns. And we can do that with the Safe Banking Act.
Aaron Pickus with the Washington Cannabis Association, 10-year anniversary of the legalization here in Washington State. Thanks so much for your time and explanation. Good luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Long before COVID-19 arrived, America was seeing a declining number of truck drivers. High demand, retirements on top of stressful long trips are some of the reasons. The American Trucking Association estimates the industry needs 80,000 more drivers. Well, in Skagit County, Washington, we actually have 3 truck driving schools and classes are booked up. Joe Hardy owns the Skagit City Trucking School and stops by Puget Sound now.
It's funny, there's probably about a million truck drivers out there, and this is data from Department of Labor, of individual CDLs that aren't working. A lot of those, I would guess, that are, you know, baby boomers that are retired, that type of thing. With, you know, it's everything deals with the markets and supply and demand. With the demand right now has increased, with the, you know, hopefully coming out of COVID, a lot of people retired.
Yeah, the silver tsunami, they call it. We see that in other industries. Is there a new wave coming in and wanting to get training and certification at a school like yours? What are you seeing there?
Yeah, there's a huge wave. Like our demand, us particularly at Skagit City, we're taking students that are filling up classes in May. So we've been constantly about 3 to 4 months out filled up with students. And that includes also wait lists on those classes coming up. And that's also based on like how we've always ran. We've always kept it kind of small. You know, mom and pa, more focused on quality, not quantity. But we've had to, you know, also downsize because of COVID. We don't run as big as classes. It's just to reduce exposure and all that stuff. But kind of, you know, where more and more people get vaccinated and you start to come out of this thing, we start to slowly increase. Another side of this bill is, you know, a shortage of truck drivers. It's really hard to find good instructors on top of that. So that's part of the you know, the supply and demand within this industry. So if you don't have the instructors, you can't really you know, increase your pool size or your classes until you can get, you know, the people to train the people to get jobs. It's kind of a, you know, it's a catch 22 right now.
So, and in your classroom, I'm assuming, is sometimes in a cab. You can't just put people in a classroom and say, here, drive a semi. They have to get in there behind the wheel, don't they?
Oh, yeah. That's another thing with this bill is you can't do it via Zoom. You know, you need the equipment in front of you. A big part of the testing with the state is what's called the pre-trip, and you have to identify parts of the vehicle, the equipment, you know, all the components. And so you need that equipment in front of you. So it's something you can't do via Zoom. It just doesn't work. It's been tried before by other schools. I talked to the school owners, and it just, the quality training is just not what it would be if you're there in person.
You have 3 schools in Skagit County, and there used to be a VocTech program also at the Skagit Community College. What's the lure? What's the attraction of Mount Vernon with so many truck driver training and certification programs?
You know, that's a good question because, you know, the population, obviously, the concentrations in the Seattle area or Snohomish County and that kind of stuff, which is part of our draw. Maybe it's because it's centralized between Whatcom County, up here, you know, we do a lot of what's San Juan Islands, Skagit County, obviously, and Snohomish County, and even a little bit out of King County. I think because of the openness of it, it's easier to train than if you were like in a downtown Seattle area, especially with new drivers trying to handle these, 75, 80 feet piece of equipment. Navigating those areas is not as easy as it is up in this area, especially for new individuals.
What's the lure of a truck driving career? What's the reward? There's monetary, but we hear about there's stressors and long trips and that sort of thing. But what are the benefits? What's the upside?
A lot of times you're your own boss, and you have that capability of becoming an owner operator if you like that avenue. The other one is there's one thing that's changed with the dichotomy of trucking. When we first started this business like 12 years ago, 70% of our students went long haul. And so you're gone for like 3 to 4 months, which is okay, if you have that passion. You have to have that passion. But a lot of them now, we're switched to where about 70% are local jobs, and they're home every day, which is really important, Bill, in this industry, because I think that's another reason for maybe the shortages is the turnover is kind of high, because it's not the easiest job in the world. So it's good to have a passion for it.
Absolutely. So at your particular school, Joe Hardy, you offer all kinds of training, but then give me just a real brief, what's the difference between CDL A and B?
Class A, as soon as you say Class A, what that means is a combination vehicle. So in other words, you have a trailer. Class B is where you don't have, the combination of trailer on there. So that's like dump truck, garbage trucks, city trucks, that type of thing that are rated over 26,001 pounds. But the class way, as soon as you put a trailer on, it's a whole different world.
I see you have a class also for school and passenger bus drivers. Is that becoming more popular? Are we, with the schools in person again, do we need qualified bus drivers?
We do. That one, as far as the school side of it, the demand has not increased that much because a lot of school districts are self-certified.
Yeah.
So they'll train their own drivers. How the costs work, it's you're not really paying for the school, but then you the school kind of, I don't want to say owns you, but you're under contract to obligate certain whatever time frames that they have that you need to work for them with that training and obtaining that CDL.
Well, Joe Hardy is the owner of Skagit City Truck School, Truck Driving School. And anything else you want to add to the conversation about the industry and what's happening right now with our shortage?
It's not that complicated. It's just, dealing with the age that we're in right now with COVID and the dichotomy of it and the economics of it. It's interesting, to say the least, just to watch times change. And I'm sure within 5 years from now, it'll change again. But who knows?
Let's hope for the best, and everybody's out there rolling and delivering products and doing it safely. More power to you. Thanks for what you do and training our workforce. Thanks for stopping by Puget Sound Now, Joe.
You bet, Bill.
On a radio program titled Puget Sound Now, we often feature stories about the saltwater estuary in our own front door, Puget Sound. It offers magnificent views, recreation, and a thriving industry. Over the past 2 years, we've been hearing a great deal about worker shortages in America's maritime industry, from well-trained seafarers on commercial ships to not enough people working the Washington State ferries. A new program in Highline Public Schools aims to attract and prepare young people for careers in the maritime industry. Stopping by Puget Sound Now is Principal Tremaine Holloway, humanities teacher Mia Malarkaroff, and ninth grader Ethan Ma. Mr. Holloway, give our listeners an idea about the concept and collaborative partnership of Maritime High School.
I think one of the reasons why Maritime High School was formulated was because the community saw a need. And just like how you mentioned earlier, Bill, there was a need to be able to transform the maritime industry from a not only from a workforce perspective, but also a diversity, equity, and inclusion perspective. And so one of the things I really admire about our core four partners, the Port of Seattle, Duwamish River Community Coalition, Northwest Maritime Center, and also obviously Highline Public Schools. We all have a vision and a mission around equity and in terms of making every decision that we do through the lens of equity. We also have a commitment to excellence and not just necessarily from an academic perspective, but also high expectations, high respect. We want the best for our kids, so we expect the best from them because they deserve the best. And then a theme around entrepreneurship. And so coming from a very innovative background, or just making sure that we are doing the next level or disruptively innovative thing, I think our core four partners really have those core ideas, really just thought about those three things and wanted to create something, especially because we're surrounded by water here in the greater Seattle area. So what better way to do that than to create a school that's going to literally transform the maritime workforce from that diversity, equity, and inclusion perspective. So that was one of the reasons, I believe, why Maritime was formulated. We have some dynamic educators on staff. We have some phenomenal students as well. And we have to envision them as the future, right? So we're just literally a part of this journey of preparing the future of the maritime workforce.
Tell me about the integrated curriculum, how it all meshes together with environmental studies and STEM and mathematics and everything. How does that all blend together to teach young people really the important parts and roles of the maritime industry?
So our goal is really to provide that exploratory opportunity for our students. I am all about how do we connect our students to their potential callings. And the way we do that is through utilizing hands-on, hearts-on, and minds-on learning activities, what we call project-based learning. So students are really doing projects that are actually going to be real-life applicable to them in the future, and really set them up on a good course for college and or career, whatever they desire to do, and have that choice in it. And so for us, the three areas of focus for us are vessel operations and design, marine research and resources, and then an area we call maritime construction. And so when you think about maritime construction, you know, what comes to mind for you is, you know, the constructing of vessels, the constructing of boats, the building, the architecture, all the math that goes into the, and all the geometry that goes into the computations to build boats and vessels. Vessel operations and design, we think about that from the perspective of how do you actually operate a boat, or how do you actually operate a vessel, and all the things that come into operating vessels, whether it's people on the ship doing the engineering work, or if the people who are actually on the ship, I think about people like chefs, I think about how the vessel is actually running and moving, all the technological piece that is there. And then you have the marine research and resources, and that is a combination of your oceanography, your marine biology, your water conservation work, your sustainable energy work, your ESG. So that's really that area there. And so a lot of our projects are geared towards those areas. So students are getting the essential standards that they need, Common Core math standards, Common Core ELA, Common Core social studies standards through the lens of maritime by having these three particular areas that we focus on. So I'll let Ms. Mia jump in, and she can give you some more explicitly granular things about projects specifically.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, so our projects start with talking to our industry community maritime partners. And we started planning this school last spring before opening in fall 2021. And we met regularly with members of our project design work groups and our advisory board who are in maritime industry, in maritime community organizations, in government as it intersects with maritime. And they helped us develop ideas of real world problems and applications that are areas that our students could engage in this kind of learning that are connected to what's going on in maritime right here in our region. And that dialogue is ongoing. I'll say, you know, we have we're starting our third project. So these are, you know, multi-week, multi-step projects that involve skill building, content learning, but also students actually out there engaging in the process, engaging in the problems, meeting with the real. I like to say I'm not the student's only teacher. I'm just the facilitator that helps connect them to the people in the industry who are their teachers as well. So that's something that we do on an ongoing basis in order to make sure that the learning that our students are doing is relevant to what our partners want them to know and be able to do and understand.
Give me an idea of one of the real world problems and how it pertains to a project you have right now, Mia.
I see Ethan's hand. So Ethan, do you want to take that one and then I can?
Yeah. So our last project, which was all about learning about microplastics and the effects that they have on the environment, One of the things that we did was we actually went to go talk to legislators. And so pretty much we had little lobby sessions to talk about the talk with legislators, pretty much having the responsibility for the plastic waste from packaging to be laid upon the producers instead of the consumers. And after the lobbying thing, one of the legislators actually started supporting one of the bills that we brought up during the session.
Ethan, tell me again why you are involved in this program and this school in particular. What makes your boat float, pardon me the pun, why is this kind of a career, maybe a potential for you?
Oh, the pun is fine. I really like puns, but as I said, I'm working here because I was really interested in the program, and I was also interested in the maritime field. And so far, I think it's been pretty fun. There's not something that I'm necessarily like super into, but I think it's really nice learning more about the industry and the different aspects of it.
Mr. Holloway, you have 37 students right now. Was there a recruitment process to try and get kids from Highline schools, or do they have to just be in the Highline public schools, or can they come from other districts too?
That's a great question. Yes, so there was a recruitment process. We actually have a lottery process for our school, so students are able to apply to our school, and we do a lottery process. Last year, our goal was getting 45. We were able to get right under 40, so it was a great retention rate there. And this year, our goal for the next class of freshmen that are coming in is to get about 100 students. And students can come from all over. We try to dedicate 55% of our students to the Highline Public School District, since that's where we are housed at, district boundaries. And then the other 45% can come from all over. So currently right now we have had students who come from Port Orchard, from Olympia, and then primarily most of our students will matriculate through the Highline School District. But yes, we are a regional high school.
If Mia is back there again, okay, I wanted to ask you about the benefits of taking your classroom to a working vessel or to a vibrant port of Seattle. What is the hands-on experience like for the students who are in your program?
What drew me here is actually I have a deep background in maritimes on both sides of my family. So for me, it was also really important to be a part of this school because on both sides of my family for generations, I've got commercial fishermen, Alaska commercial fishermen, marine construction. And I felt like growing up steeped in the industry, I wanted to be a part of that transformation and kind of be a bridge between some of what is the traditions and longstanding generational connection to maritime, but also with a looking forward to what's next. So that was why it was important for me to come on board with this.
Mr. Holloway, did you ever have maritime background, or what made you want to be the principal of this fledgling school?
No, actually, that's what I always lead with, too. I do not have the maritime background or knowledge or expertise. But one of the things that really gravitated me towards this opportunity was just being able to do something new, do something that's going to change the future. As you're probably aware, when you look at the maritime industry in regards to the different sectors and also the opportunities of jobs and job positions that are available, that piece is pretty diverse. But when it comes to the actual workforce, the human capital, that is not. And so my goal as principal is really to be able to create a school such as Maritime High School that's going to help transition and literally transform the maritime industry from the diversity, equity, and inclusion perspective. So my goal is to connect the folks who need power, who are our students, to those who have power in the maritime industry so that the maritime industry can be powerful. So I just have a really strong passion for being a lifelong learner and an insatiable curiosity. And so I've always been curious about maritime. And so that's what has connected me to my passion, which is helping change the future of maritime.
Thanks again to Tremaine Holloway, Mia Malakaroff, and Ethan Ma, all with Maritime High School in Des Moines. And thanks to all my guests for another informative half hour. I'm Bill Swartz. We're back again with Puget Sound Now next Sunday morning.
Thank you for listening to Puget Sound Now. Tune in every Sunday morning to learn about the issues happening in our communities around the Sound. Puget Sound Now is a public service of Lotus Seattle Corp.